Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
Hey everyone, welcome to Masters of Modern. We're here today, and this is the episode about Judges Are Your Friends. We're going to be talking about judges, and we're going to also break down the Modern deck Storm. I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Glenn Jones.
Hello everyone, how's it going?
And today we have Leo Maris visiting us from Venice Beach.
Well, close. Culver City.
Venice, Culver City.
I don't know where any of those places are.
The same, the same thing. They have the same movie theaters. All right. So today we're talking about judges. So Leo here is a judge. How's that feel? What does that mean to the world out there? What is a judge?
Well, all right. So judges are the officiating force, I guess, in tournaments. They're the ones that try to, like, enforce the rules. Make sure the tournament runs smoothly and basically provide a competitive environment where magic can actually unfold in paper magic.
Okay, so you're an elite force of highly trained individuals with a vindictive vendetta to protect all players from each other and their cheating brethren.
That's great.
Okay. So today's kind of, you know, something that a lot of players, I think, when they first walk into Magic tournaments, they have this fear of judges or judge-based environments, more highly competitive things. At least I know I did, where, you know, you're walking into a situation and you've been told your whole life tattling is bad. So, you know, I'm at a table playing someone, and when I'm playing them, if they do something wrong or even if I have a question, at first, as a new player, I will generally be like, well, I don't want to ask the question because I don't want the guy I'm playing with, who's my new friend, to think I think he's a bad person. So I just won't call a judge on things. You know, today what we really want to bring across is that this is a bad mentality. We want to encourage people that judges are really there to help you. They're a tool brought, you know, encouraged by wizards to be in these environments to make it so that rules and the tournaments go as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, I've always kind of felt like it was sort of this deep-seated societal, like, authority thing. You know, like, people generally don't like to involve the cops in anything, regardless of whether the cops should be involved or not. You know, people view that happening as, like, a bad thing because only bad things require the involvement of the cops. But that's not actually true. Like, there's all kinds of roles, and especially when it comes to magic, which is obviously significantly less dangerous than anything a cop would handle.
You call a judge over, you're not like, oh, I forgot that I might go to jail now, that thing that I did wrong, no. Like, it's like,
people view calling a cop as, like, escalation in all circumstances. And in case of magic, like, calling a judge can be escalation, but it's not the default mode. Right. Like, generally, it's, you know, like, calling for a target representative and a target. It's, like, not that you just need a little help and don't know where something is or how something works, and you just flag them down.
It's a really good way of putting it. Yeah. No, I mean, we do come across a little bit strong sometimes, intimidating, in certain circumstances.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody going from tabletop magic over to competitive, it's definitely a little daunting to interact with us, at least from a new player's perspective.
Yeah. I mean, the way I got kind of around the problem of judges and being able to call on them is, you know, something, a habit that is actually good is just call them for everything. When it really comes down to it, like, if you have a question, if there is anything going wrong, even if you think you're doing something wrong, or even if you're like, well, I don't know if, like, this morph creature, when it flips over, is at instant speed or if it's on the stack or not, call a judge, because the person that you're playing against, especially at REL tournaments, isn't your friend. They could be friendly and they could be your friend, but they are not there to help you win. They're there to help themselves win, so it's better to ask a judge to be there for you in those situations than not.
Right. I think the key word here is that we are playing in a competitive environment, okay? In a competitive environment, there are rules that have to be followed, and a winner and a loser have to be determined, okay? We can't all win. It's not how this –
We can't all win?
No.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
We can all win at having fun at playing Magic,
right.
which is more
not the way I play.
Yeah. But, you know, we do also need to provide the integrity of, hey, that win actually matters, right? So it's the people who are competing for not only the prize, but also there's a sense of accomplishment beating everybody else or being the you know, number one champion at a, you know, X amount of player tournament. There's a lot of, you know, gravitas that comes with
it. Well, it's a competitive environment and, you know, people are taking it seriously. There's money and or pride and or important things on the line, plane tickets, and so, like, these are situations where people are going to take it seriously, and judges allow an environment where, you know, you as a new player won't be taken advantage of by being new to the mm-hmm. environment and make sure that you don't make mistakes that sometimes people make.
And following through from, like, the, you know, the highest tiers of competitive play, like Pro Tours and all of that, and all the way down to, you know, things like FNM or even just random weekly tournaments, like, the one of the things the judges are always there to do is protect specifically, and what you were alluding to, like, the integrity of the game. Like, if you win a game where something went wrong, that kind of, that salts it, right? Like, it's not quite the same. But when you win a game, everyone did everything legally, no one made any, you know, over steps as far as the right. rules go, and you know that victory was determined on the merits of play and the rules of the game. Like, that's how you want every game to be, you right. know, you know, that's why cheating is so frowned upon everywhere, because it goes outside the integrity of the game. And I don't think that, I'm not saying, you know, necessarily that judges only correct cheating, because you can very accidentally disrupt the integrity of a game.
Right.
It's very easy to do. You know, you forget to put a creature in the graveyard and it just sits on the battlefield. Like, right. you weren't cheating, but, like, that obviously affects that game negatively.
I mean, and to your detriment, to your, like, there are times where I forgot on the draw card. Because, like, yeah. I was like, oh, I have at the beginning of my upkeep effect, bam. And then I'm like, oh, I didn't draw a card. And that's a situation you want to run it back, call a judge maybe if it's how far it is. And then they'll kind of help you figure out the best way to make it fair for both players to make sure that the game state kind of goes ahead as it's supposed to have gone in the first place.
Right. Now, I mean, when somebody commits an error, you know, the severity of that error could range anywhere from, you know, just a quick, easy verbal communication that says, hey, that was, you made a mistake, that's a warning, you know, don't try not to do it again, you know.
Right.
But there, and then it goes down deeper into, like, oh man, you forgot to do something that, you know, moved a card from one zone to another, and you know, and we're like 4 or 5 turns ahead, and then all of a sudden, you know, we have this game state that, like, can't be repaired because, you know, under the guidelines of backing up that we get. You know, when somebody forgets to, like Glenn mentioned, put a creature in the graveyard and a few turns have passed, unfortunately, all the decisions that have been made since that mistake was happening factor in that creature existing on the battlefield.
Right.
And then at that point, you know, while to certain people might seem like this is completely unfair, we would leave the game state as is because of all the decisions that have been made since that point
right.
have factored this creature being on the battlefield. Going to try to take all those decisions back actually is a more detrimental, like, disruption to the game state than the actual
creature being there. Right.
Which, I mean, and I, explaining this to players, sometimes, like, they don't understand. This is, creature is clearly an advantage to them, like a huge one.
Right, yeah. Right.
And
wait, you're saying that I want to have creatures in play while playing Magic, the game about playing creatures and attacking your opponent?
At least in Standard.
Well, very we'll be true. Getting to that, how that's not true in a very, very specific deck.
Right.
So, kind of moving on, what are some things you want to players to kind of keep, or what are things that players should keep in mind about judges, one, coming into a tournament? Things like specific ways that, you know, the correct way to communicate with them, the correct way to interact with players when a judge is at the table, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so while every judge has their own way of judging, there is kind of a sort of a generalized, I guess, demeanor that we're all supposed to share at the table. Okay, we're supposed to all be very cordial and polite to all the players when we take one. If a judge, like, comes up to you or comes to the table rather brash or upset or anything like mm-hmm. that, you can take his demeanor into account, and this is why a floor judge is a floor judge. And well, hold on, let me explain the structure before we...
Yeah, that probably
makes more sense. Okay, so... There, in a tournament setting, there's always going to be floor judges who are the first responders to any kind of need or call that players have. And then there's always a head judge who kind of oversees all the decisions that are made in the tournament. He or she is the final say in all regards. So the way a call is taken, this player initially calls for judge very loud, holds their hand up, and the judge comes over, whoever's the closest one.
Right.
And they attend to your needs, and if you don't like the ruling or the way that they handled the call, you can always appeal. And the appeal goes to the head judge. The head judge will come over, assess the situation just like the floor judge did, with all the, you know, facts up to that point, and then make a ruling based on what he or she...
Right, based off of the judge of the call of the first
floor
judge and his own
investigation
of the process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's always available to you. The head judge, unfortunately...
Appealing.
Yeah, yeah. Appealing is always available to you, and you should always use that if you feel even not even remotely comfortable with, like, if a judge tells you, I think this is how it goes, and he sounds a little dubious in his conviction, you can always call over the head judge and or at least appeal him. And like, I feel like a lot of players don't use this enough.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
I agree.
I think, I mean, totally honest, from a perspective of one of these players is sometimes, especially for newer players, you guys, is they don't know what's available. They don't know, and they also don't know how appropriate it is to use it as, like, they've just gotten over the fact that, oh, I should call judges for things. Now I have to, like, call the judges judge and, like,
exactly.
Level up to, like, the bigger bad guy. So, like, and they're not bad guys. And so, like, that's kind of where the weird perception comes from.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Basically, I mean, the what I want to emphasize here is that judges are humans, too, and we do make mistakes. And it isn't totally within the realm of possibility that a judge gets it wrong. I know myself, I've, you know, made a lot of bad calls when I was level one, you know. Now I've had a few years of experience, and that doesn't happen as much. But there are moments where I don't get it right. Okay, and getting another set of eyeballs on the situation, regardless of whether or not the level three judge is going to rule in the same manner that I did. I mean, or sorry, the head judge, I should say, not the level three, but it could be four or five.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have a better experience and knowledge of the game rules than I currently have. And they would otherwise, you know, be able to supply a further insight into the, you know, altercation or situation that occurred.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are five levels of judge.
There are.
And the process for getting to each of those levels are?
There's a different criteria for each one, but basically, like, the general assumption is you take a test that tests your rules knowledge and pass an interview that requires you to interact with a higher level judge and see if you've actually obtained the appropriate skills and or
rules knowledge
to pass to be performing at the level that is expected. So level ones, that's where you start. You start at level zero. If you want to start judging at FNMs and stuff like that, you don't have to do anything. You can just talk to the judge who's judging there and say, I want to help out. And then they'll start mentoring you. And that's the judge program is all like volunteer mentor based.
Right. Yeah, right.
We judge because we want to. Obviously there's other motivations, but that's the main one.
Right. they really are donating their time in many senses to help these tournaments. A lot of times, you know, their situation, they love playing, they love being in the environment, but they're not, they're better suited, and they feel like they enjoy more helping players than they do necessarily competing in the tournaments.
Right, yeah, no, there is a sense of, like, you know,
Community
and or fulfillment when you do serve as a officiator for these things.
Sure.
Yeah. Said, yeah, the amount of responsibility that you take on as you move up the levels just is exponential, is the way I would kind of describe it. Like, level ones, your responsibility is to basically one store. Level twos are local judges, local area judges, which means they're responsible for, like, a greater part of the community. They're at the current standings, the way that Wizards wrote things out, you can't have a store PTQ without having a level judge present, which is a new rule for all stores to apply by 2015, I think, is when it starts.
Right, I think
and a good rule.
Yeah.
Level twos are competitive rule enforcement level judges. At level passing the going f- level one test, know your basic rules of the game. I would say about 6 months of like actual play experience, you can probably be ready for the level one test.
And level ones are generally FNMs, random store open tournaments versus like a GP, for instance, has only level two judges at a minimum, correct?
No, there's some level ones that come on, but they're very close to level two.
Okay.
Yeah. It's almost always people who are like planning to test that weekend or if the tournament is particularly understaffed, they might like recruit some locals, which could be a larger problem going forward.
Right. But, we mentioned last week, GP Vegas had probably a grip of level ones just because they ran out of judges.
GP Vegas, Sean Cantonese was our regional coordinator at the time. He's a level four now, he's no longer our regional coordinator, but that's okay. We still like him a lot.
Right.
He basically like just blew the battle horn and told everyone to sign up for this event because we needed literally every available judge that would actually volunteer to participate. So that was kind of cool to see everybody there. We did, yeah. And
a lot of people flew in from other countries. There was at least three judge interactions I had where, like, English was not the first language.
No, definitely not. No, this tournament, it was cool to work the biggest Magic tournament.
Right, right. I can imagine.
Fun fact, I called the draft day two, so I called the largest Magic draft.
Congratulations. Oh, okay.
Not bad.
There's a shout-out right there.
Yeah.
That's a lifetime achievement. You should have a little badge that you wear.
Yeah, it'll last at least probably like a year.
Yeah. We'll see.
I'm reveling in the next 5,000
yeah, person. Yeah, I know. Oh, man.
But, yeah, so level twos are your you know, competitive REL judges who are very in tuned with how all the procedures work for competitive environments and have more than usually are pretty good at making sure things go the right way when you call them over for rules or any kind of interactions. Now, a newly minted level two is not going to have nearly the skills that a, like, veteran 1 to 2 year L2 is going to have.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's to be expected, which is why, like, those newly minted L2s are going to need to get appealed every once in a while. And you should always, like, if you don't ever take a judge for its face value if you feel like something's wrong, right? Like, if they... I've been to, you know, calls where I've completely reversed my ruling based on one more sentence the guy says because he didn't include that in his initial, like,
right. Effect. Oh, yeah. I mean, Magic is probably the most, if not one of the most complicated mm-hmm. games out there.
Yeah.
And, comparably, computer games, everything's kind of checked for you, which is why Modo doesn't need judges. But in real life, you know, there is a bunch of pieces of cardboard that mean things. And sometimes people don't represent what that means correctly, or they don't assume how it works the way it works, and therefore people make mistakes.
The nature of Magic as, you know, a game that frequently people start playing at their house or kitchen table or whatever also contributes a lot to that, because the idiosyncrasies of, you know, house rules how you learn to play your spells or whatever can certainly, you know, contribute to people not meaning to, but just, you know, incidentally and repetitively affecting a game state negatively. One of the most, like, larger flaws, and the Magic rules have actually been, like, sort of manipulated to allow for is the actual casting of a spell. There are essentially, you know, two ways to cast your spell, and that's, like, not really normal for any other game, like any card game. You know, it's the correct, you know, associate mode is, you know, you announce your spell and you pay the cost associated with your spell. But so many people at their kitchen table, they learn Magic by they tap all their lands first and then play their spell, or, like, do something else and then the spell for it.
Right.
And so there's this kind of, like, misordering of costs and announcements that can go awry and targeting and things like that. And so that's actually one of the more confusing areas, I think, for players, like, learning when they're supposed to say, I'm playing the spell, I'm targeting this guy, I'm paying this cost for it. Yeah, things like that. Especially abilities that would be, you know, like, sacrifice a creature, target creature gets +2/+2. Like, can I, you know, how can I play this card? Can I target the sacked guy? Like, et cetera, et cetera. And people just don't, that's not a super intuitive way because they come with so many misconceptions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's your first competitive event and you've, like, gone from tabletop Magic to this, you're going to get a few warnings.
Right.
Like, guaranteed. Not...
I mean, there's, like, small things. Like, the sideboard as a concept is something that tabletop doesn't have, and so are you allowed to have 15 cards? I've been in tournaments where I've walked in and the person, like, plays their deck and then has an entire white box of cards and they start switching in and out of their deck, and I'm like, you can't do that.
100 and, oh, you don't like the 500 right. card sideboard?
Yeah, yeah.
It's so good though.
Binder board.
I mean, and part of the problem is sometimes the mentality is this, and this is kind of on the onus of the player, is as a new player, you should not get mad sometimes at your opponent if they call a judge on you for some of these mistakes.
Because
in these situations, like, I felt like the bad guy for telling this guy that you can't have a 500-card sideboard, or he looked at me like I was the bad guy. And in that situation, you're like, well, now I feel bad for playing correctly, and that's a mentality you don't want to happen in the community.
No. One of the ways I like to handle, like, almost all situations like that where I know that my opponent has done something that they're not allowed to do or has a misinterpretation of how a rule works or something like that is I explain my understanding of how the rule correctly works, and then I say, but you should definitely call a judge to make sure. Because that sort of removes the feeling that, like, I'm like, you don't know how this works, I'm calling a judge.
Right,
you know, which
right,
they
right.
feel as they feel like offended or a little accused by that. But instead I'm, you know, moving, you know, this is how it works, but you should make sure And then it's them learning from the judge instead of me bringing the judge to correct them. And it's the same end result, but it obviously, like, feels totally different when players, you're the one initiating the judge call.
The players have more respect for each other at the table. They don't. There's not as many feel-bad moments. The judge is there as a helper, which is a good habit for the player to learn. It's kind of a better application to how you deal with rule inconsistencies than most people's reaction, which is judge, and then a judge comes over and it's a little bit more antagonistic than it should be.
That's true. Having clear communication with your opponent is actually something I encourage in all my, like, head judge announcements when I start today. And it's almost never followed a lot of the times.
Yeah.
Which sucks. But, you know, unfortunately, it's kind
of... I like to talk to strangers.
Yeah. There's that. You know,
the
antisocial aspect of our player base, that happens. But also the, let's just, like... You know, trying to encourage, like...
Well, tensions are high. You're, like, I'm running on adrenaline, and, like, which is surprising because it's a carb game, but, like, you know, if you're in round three and you're 1-1 and, like, everything hinges on something, you're stressed out, and which is why sometimes these tournaments are so exhausting. And that's, you know, when tensions are high, people are not the nicest.
I agree. Yeah, you've used all your brain power to try to calculate a certain move, and now you have to waste some on... dealing with somebody's behavior or, you know, they're handling a situation that goes against all the decisions you've already made.
Right.
Right?
Right, right.
Which is where the true sportsmanship shines through for people.
All right, so next we're going to move on to, you know, a couple things that you want players to know, either be they rule kind of situations or how to interact with judges at the table in a tournament environment. I'll let you start because you're the judge, and so
what do you want us to know?
Yeah, one of the most important things everybody should know, regardless of what you how you may think of us when you initially go in, how we swing our authority, etc., whatever, it doesn't matter. One of the most important things that we don't explicitly say, but it's sort of inherent in the way that we handle things, is you should never ever lie to a judge. It's part of the rules, but people think that we're always asking questions to see if we can lead you into trouble, which, you know, some people feel very defensive when we start asking them, hey, what exactly
just like happened? The cops.
Exactly. Just don't, entrapment. Honestly, it's, don't lie, just be fully straightforward, don't withhold anything, because that can always be escalated unnecessarily.
Right.
It happens way too much. When I ask people, hey, what happened here, they give me a very vague story, which doesn't actually answer my question a lot of the times. And then I'll ask him again just to verify to make sure that they're still, you know, trying to at least maybe give them a second chance. And if they still come up with a, you know, some circumvention, I have to assume that they're cheating or at least trying to protect something for some reason.
They're trying to obscure the truth. So if you're going to lie Kaiser Soze style, you know, really work the story, get a lot of specifics.
Essentially, yeah.
Not that I'm encouraging you to become better liars, but... I definitely get what you mean. And obviously, you know, people just around other humans, you kind of realize when someone is, you know, trying to lie, especially when they're bad at, like, children. You know, they'll, like, not give you the full truth or, like, hem and haw a little bit about certain details, and you're like, look, man, just be square. Like, it's probably fine. And by and large, I think it is probably fine. Like, all of the stories I've heard where someone got DQ'd for lying, not all, but, like, the vast majority, like, there was no penalty for what they actually did or no significant penalty, like a warning or something like that. But then the fact that they lied about it, it had to escalate from that point. That you cannot allow people to lie to judges. It just has to be, like, the most significantly punished activity, really.
Well, yeah.
I mean, among them, like, because it's easily the most destructive. A judge just can't do their job if players are not telling the truth. It's impossible.
And when it comes to that, I mean, we've talked about it already, before that, judges are there to help. And by lying to them, you're making it so they can't help. And it's a way that is malicious intent normally. So it's a way that's hard to look fondly on when all they're there is they're donating their time to help you figure out what's going on.
I wouldn't say malicious. I would say self-interested.
Yeah,
that's probably more accurate because a lot of the times people, you know, they're like, it's not really a big deal, so I'm just going to conceal it. Like, that's like kind of their thinking. They're rationalizing it to themselves, obviously. And that comes from their self-interest. But, you know, and in many cases, they might be right. Like, it might not actually be a big deal. But that means you should be honest about it, not that you should conceal it.
Yep, exactly. I mean, there's been more times than I care to share that, like, the situation could have been that much easier handled and, You know, we could have gone right to the ruling and getting them back to playing Magic, whereas instead I have to spend 5, even 10 minutes investigating why this person isn't being so forthcoming. Like, what's the problem here?
Right.
And it's really just, you know, don't do it. And we'll get along just fine. If a call has lasted more than 60 seconds, you are entitled to a time extension.
Mm-hmm.
Anything less than 60 seconds and you ask for a time extension, the judge is going to frown at you and say, no, play Magic. That's a little too sharky.
Yeah, it's again, you know, a privilege that you don't want to abuse. Like, they're there to try and make sure that they help the experience without necessarily making it any worse for either party, but there are limits.
Yep. And I guess one of the last things I want to touch up on is judges actually cannot provide advice. So the way you mm-hmm. ask questions as far as how certain cards play out, you need to make it real easy for us and create a scenario that is in a vacuum, not directly from the game state that you're actually currently representing. What I mean by that is, if you ask, hey, how does my card, if I do this on my opponent's things, what will happen is too
vague.
It's too vague. It honestly puts us in a weird position because you're asking us if the move that you're about to make is good. Is good.
Is this a good play? Should I do this?
Should I? Yeah, stuff like that. Like, you can't word it that way. So asking us instead, hey, if I play this card on this particular scenario and nothing else happens, what would be the outcome of the stack, or how does the rule scenario play?
A good example is like, so, and this is a common mistake a lot of people play, and we haven't actually touched upon it yet, so this is good to kind of bring it up here, is Tarmogoyf and Lightning Bolt.
Yep.
Where the way you would assume it would work is Tarmogoyf is an X3, so he, like, a land and a sorcery are in the graveyard.
Because they thought seized you, those scum! Thought,
yeah. And so you're like, oh, I have Lightning Bolt, I can kill Tarmogoyf. So you Lightning Bolt the Goyf. And Goyf won't die, because the Lightning Bolt will go into the graveyard before Tarmogoyf is killed by state-based actions, which are complicated and we don't need to go fully into right now. But what it breaks down to is that before the Tarmogoyf has the chance to die, the Lightning Bolt would be in the graveyard. You can ask a judge, if I Lightning Bolt this Tarmogoyf, will it kill it? Correct?
And if I Lightning Bolt this Tarmogoyf with
yeah, that's, you want to specify the...
Yeah.
As a 2-3, because this and this, and I Lightning Bolt it, and nothing else happens.
Right. Well, will the Tarmogoyf...
Where will the Tarmogoyf be?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
In the graveyard or in play?
Right.
And the answer is, I would say it would be in play.
Right.
Right? But if you just come up and say, hey, I have a Tarmogoyf, my opponent has this and this in the graveyard, I bolt it, you know... Would the Tarmogoyf die? And I'm like, I have no idea. Your opponent could do something in response.
Right, right. Yeah.
Also worth noting is, you know, a lot of these questions, specificity, as we've, you know, said, is very good. For example, there's a big difference between, you know, if I Lightning Bolt a Tarmogoyf that has a sorcery and a land in the graveyard, will it die? Versus, can I Lightning Bolt a Tarmogoyf? Because you can always pretty much Lightning Bolt a Tarmogoyf,
right.
But that's not what you're trying to figure out. You're trying to figure out the result of an action. So, you know, and that can be, the judge is not allowed to correct you in that instance, right? Like,
no.
Yeah, if you say, can I Lightning Bolt a Tarmogoyf? Yeah, they just have to say, yeah, like, that is a legal thing you can do with a Lightning Bolt. It's
yep.
not necessarily going to be as, they can't say, but, like, obviously, it might not be as productive as you're imagining.
I mean, I can't ask questions for you.
Right.
I can try to clarify, because I know how people's intentions kind of end up being, right? But if you ask me a straightforward question, like, can I bolt this Tarmogoyf, without asking me, will it die in this scenario with nothing else happening, you know, there's...
Right. Yeah. You'll fall into the trap.
You're beholden to your code.
And then you bolt the Tarmogoyf, and then I tell you it's not dead, and you're like, you said I could, and I'm like, yeah, I did.
And you did.
It's got 3 damage marked on it.
Achievement unlocked.
I'm sorry you didn't get as far as you wanted with that Lightning Bolt, but, you know,
it's close.
You're probably close. You got another one?
It won't grow now. There's already one.
Wait, let's do a quick planeswalker check.
And then finally, guys, there's one of the last things I want to touch up on is sometimes you will have bad interactions with judges. Okay?
Right.
That's one thing you will have come across. Whether it be the judge's fault or your own, just know that it takes 2 people to have an altercation. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the best you can do as far as, and you want to be on the judge's side, you really do. But sometimes, you know, there's going to be situations where a judge isn't feeling it that day, or, you know, there's the human element, you know.
Right.
That,
people that are people.
People are people. And that's why there's always an appeal process. But also, don't ever be rude to judges if you can help it.
Right. Right?
They're, as soon as you get on the judge's bad side, it is never going to go good for you.
Right. And normally, you're also, you're like, Magic is not a, it is a wide community, but it is also semi-tight-knit where, like, if I piss off a judge in the area I live, they're going to be judging at every event I play in forever, unless they move or I move.
Yep.
And so, A, grudges in the long run are probably not good. B, these are people that are donating their time in many ways to help, you know, the tournament go better. So, really, they're just trying to do the best they can. And there is a level of respect and or just respect that you should have for other people that you don't want to really carry over to any other parts of emotions and life and beyond.
Yep.
And while it, and that's a very good point, I would like to point out, it does kind of cut, you know, we mentioned how judges can make mistakes, so it kind of can cut both ways. Obviously, you know, when a judge makes a mistake, it's, you know, often the player may resent that judge. Like, that's probably one of the vast majority, I think, maybe not vast majority, but a significant percentage of negative opinions or negative relationships between judges and players come from a judge goofing something and a player getting upset about it. I think that that's reasonably common. And, you know, in those, I've had that situation happen a lot of times. Been playing on Magic a long time, and not to say the judge has been messed up a bunch, but it's been a while. And in that situation, you know, if a judge comes back later and, you know, is like, you know, hey, I messed that up, I'm sorry about that, that was my bad, it, like, it does so much more for my relationship with that judge than them just, you know, pretending it never happened or anything like that. Because, like, I walk away from that interaction if I get a bad ruling, or I'm just like, that judge is bad at his job. I don't want that judge, like, judging my matches. That's the only, like, real response I can have. Like, even though it was a mistake and he's human or whatever, you know, it's still, it's just the human response, you know, like, I was wronged. And that's kind of difficult to overlook. But an apology or just, you know, again, you know, we're all people, like, it goes a long way.
Well, and I would say, it goes both ways, and B, it really comes down to what we were saying before, which is communication is key.
Yeah.
Talk. I mean, like, if you have a problem with, and these are people that are in a position where they're not going to, like, have a secondary altercation if you go up and apologize.
Yeah. And like, I've certainly been rude to a judge as well and come back later, you know, like, that was uncalled for. I'm sorry about that. Dude.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just a lot of good sportsmanship, but, like, just generally speaking, you know, don't
get be on, a dick. The Will Wheaton policy. Yeah,
essentially, yeah. It is. Also, I encourage judges that I mentor and or interact with all the time to make sure that they go up to players, and if they botch a call, like, say, I was wrong, and like Glenn mentioned, because we need to look good in the community regardless of whether or not we do things correctly or not.
Right, right.
And even outside of just the, you know, politeness of it, it's also important, like, you don't want that player to continue walking around thinking that the card's working correctly. You know, if you've given them the wrong call, they very well might just walk away from it with that.
Right. The last part before we start getting onto the deck tech is, how do I become a judge? What is the beginning? How do I start the process to make that happen?
Blood oath.
Okay.
Yep.
Say vows, go to a dark cave.
Yep. Slice your hand open, high five.
Okay, good. Cool. All right.
That's step one.
Okay, so you have, step one is play competitive Magic. Okay, I don't think any person has, like, gone from tabletop Magic to being like, I want to judge this, because you have no idea what you're talking
certainly
about.
Certainly not in Kept With It, I think.
No, yeah. No. So, let's say you see people being judges, you need to be a competitive player first and foremost. Okay, so play a lot of competitive Magic and get a feel for, hey, I actually want to be enforcing the rules that actually occur here.
Right.
Because if you have no idea what that is, then...
Worth pointing out is it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be, like, you know, a pro tour class player or anything like that. It just means you need to be familiar with the environment that you're going to be working
in. Right.
Exactly. Right. Step two is, get in contact with whatever judge you see on the regular.
Right.
Yeah. If there's judges who constantly judge all things all the time, and there's going to, at larger scale events, you know, connecting with level two, even a level three, is also a really good starting point.
Right.
Approaching them and saying, I want to be a level, or I want to be a judge. I've, you know, been playing for a little bit and it's appealing to me.
Right.
That's the question you kind of say to them. And they're like, are you sure? It's typically the follow-up question. Yeah, you sure? You sure you want to do this? And then they're like, if the answer is yes and you take the blue pill, then we take you down the rabbit hole. But you know, we just want to make sure that, you know.
That's when the high-fiving with blood and sacred rites start happening.
Yeah, essentially. It's best to then start thinking about how much time you want to start dedicating to being a judge, because it's going to take a few hours. And by few, I mean like 100.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
It's, give or take. I'd want to see about, for an L1 candidate, like a good judge is 100 right. hours, but a L1 candidate's going to put at least 10 to 15 hours worth of studying, shadowing, judge training before they take the level
right,
test.
Right.
Oops. Yeah.
I mean, if you're very far along in, like, let's say you've been playing competitive Magic for like 2 or 3 years and you want to just all of a sudden become a judge, then okay, that's going to be fast tracked a little bit because you know where the rules knowledge is. But this is, you know, addressing more of the newer players to competitive environment.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah. Definitely.
And then there's after you've convinced a level 2 or even a level 1 to sort of like guide you through the initial process. Mm-hmm. You've shadowed them, you've really engaged in like a couple calls, maybe you've judged a few FNMs. Now you're at a point where you're like, okay, I'm thinking about maybe actually getting a level 1 certification. There comes a written test, a multiple choice test, and an interview that goes along with it. Basically, in the multiple choice test, it's strictly trying to determine if you have the skill set required to judge Magic at a certain level, which right. is the most basic.
Mm-hmm.
Then, there are these many layers. What order do they happen? Well, A, B, and C.
Sort of like being able to run a 4-40 or whatever. Like you gotta hit something to get on the field. Like,
yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. And then the interview happens where it, for level 1 anyways, it's more of like, hey, introduction to the actual community, and this is what you're going to be expecting, and it's a lot of information that gets, you know, bestowed upon you. But also, one of the things I like to do when I certify level 1s is ask them what their plan is. Right. What tracks you to the judge
Always
program?
A good question.
What do you want to do within it? Do you just want to be a level 1 local judge that just judges here, or do you want to do something else? Because we have resources available to get you where you want to be.
Right, right. Right?
And sometimes they don't know. Sometimes it's like, no, I just want to try.
Right, right.
You know, I just
want a better understanding of the rules in my store.
Could use a judge,
and I just, you know.
And given the demographic of the average Magic player, you know, you're going to have a lot of people who are relatively early in their lives or who are still, you know, splitting a lot of their time amongst hobbies and or school and or work, and that's, you know,
right,
a fine time to be experimenting with something like that, and you're just trying out a different kind of responsibility.
Right. Yep, exactly. And then, you know, then if you're already pretty serious about it, then there's ways and means to escalate your involvement and advancement through the program. But typically speaking, a lot of this is, there's no hand-holding. Mm-hmm. I don't really do any hand-holding with regard to if somebody approaches me and saying, hey, I want to be a judge, okay, then show me.
Right, right.
Yeah. If you really do want to, you'll follow the instructions I give you and do the tasks required in order to actually become a good judge, because more than ever, we need to be producing quality judges that can actually perform at the level of competition
Definitely.
That we're like
trying to encourage and,
yes.
and expected and to it, be able to follow through with.
Honestly, it's at this point right now, we're kind of hitting a ceiling with how many judges we can train at once, right?
Right,
we,
right.
We can populate only so many, but give or take, like, where you need about 10 competitive REL events before I consider you to be a solid, well-rounded level 2 competitive level judge.
Right, right.
And those events happen over the course of about a year, and the way Magic is exploding and keeping up, it's getting to a point where the resources in any given local area are especially, I'm dreading a little bit 2015, to be honest, about how...
Well, you got a couple months.
Right, yeah. How many L2s can I make in 3 months? Let's see. Yeah, so, I mean, we have people who are very interested, and we're trying to push them along and encourage them as best we can to attend and learn and figure things out. And that's why I said that there's a human element involved when calling a judge over, but that... Like, if you're not going to judge and somebody else is, and, I mean, give them that respect of how much time they've already put in to try to actually be a resource.
Yeah, right.
For the tournament, yeah. I've dealt with rude people before, and it's very annoying. Cause
rude people that want to become judges, or rude as in just random
just
people
random
in a room
players,
that are rude? Okay.
Yeah, who think that, you know, they're entitled to certain things. And
right.
you know, their viewpoint of, like, I'm a player, I'm better than you, you should just be, like, kissing my feet type of, like,
right.
attitude.
There is this, like, those who can't play judge mentality. But, like, as you've said, you know, specifically playing is a very important step and a maintenance level even of judging well. Yep. Like,
it is. And I, to an extent, that is true. Judges tend to be not the greatest players in the...
They're certainly not as practiced. But, yeah. I mean, at the same time, they're experienced in aspects of the game that the players aren't. That's specifically why they're there.
Right. It's also two different perspectives, especially, like, if you're not playing in that tournament. Because if I'm playing, then I'm worried about manipulating the board state of my opponent to winning through the spells and creatures I have available to me. As a judge, I'm just wanting to make sure that those things you're doing are allowed.
Yeah. Instead of, like, outthinking your opponent, you have to outthink people.
Right. Which makes sense why the EDH community came from the judging community, because mm-hmm. EDH and multiplayer play are so much more about
player relationships
than they are about necessarily knowing, like, oh, I need to play spell A plus B plus C to do what needs to happen to win.
Yep. So, I mean, yeah, that's, if you're interested in judging, you know, that's how you become one. Go to enough competitive events where you actually understand how competitive Magic is supposed to play out. Contact a level one local judge or a level two if you can find one, and then ask them how to continue that process, and hopefully they'll mentor you. Now, hopefully means that you've proven yourself to them and they have the time and resources to give you in order to become that. And if they don't, they'll usually direct you to somebody else who can.
Right.
It's inherent as part of the program in general, when you choose to become a judge, that you're supposed to pass on information to other judges.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're supposed to teach and grow the community. It's part of the job.
Right.
So,
well, that's what being an elite order is. It's training more to be part of your order.
And that's what we're working on right now. So we can definitely use people if you're interested.
So, if you're listening to this podcast, you should email Leo.
For more information specifically, and we'll get this email, the command cast, and we'll kind of lead you guys. And also below the podcast on rocketjump.com, there'll be a link to the judge program main site. So you can kind of do research there. So before, you know, now that we've kind of gone over judge, it's time for the deck tech. Woo. We should get a theme song.
I think it should be like robotic.
Oh,
like
Yeah, or like just straight metal screaming.
Deck tech! Deck! Wow!
I'm going to just use that. So today we're talking about a deck called Storm. So something we're going as a podcast do is when we have guests, especially have decks that we know that they have a lot of experience with. So Leo, you are a self-professed player of the deck Storm in multiple tournaments.
Yep.
And you know, as we've talked about with Affinity and Blue, White, Red, we're going to kind of break down what the deck does, some of the key cards, and then move into kind of what it does against the specific major pillars of the format.
Grapeshot them next.
So to kind of explain what the deck does, Leo?
Go for it. The deck is one of those decks that plays by itself. There's very little interaction with your opponent. You basically try to cast as many spells as you can in one turn, and then a card called Grapeshot, which has a mechanic called Storm on it, that says every time when you play the spell, you copy it for each however many spells you've played before at this turn.
Right. So Storm is a mechanic that we mentioned earlier in the previous episode of the podcast, where it's actually one of the most broken mechanics ever printed, according to Wizards, where there is a scale of card types that they will print in Standard ever again, and it is named after Storm as the least likely to ever be printed in Standard.
Yeah. Somehow we went from, like, Time Spiral to Storm, and we went the wrong way as far as fixing how we do free spells.
One of the most degenerate forms of Magic is free spells, right?
Right.
Being able to play something without actually paying a cost for it is inherently of itself just unfair in resources.
Right.
So Storm is one of those mechanics when you get to just copy something for free, just because you cast a bunch of spells before it this turn, and it plays into that idea.
Right. And using the tools available in Modern, there are many ways to, like, with cantripping and mana rituals, which are cards that you cast mana and they give you a net greater amount of mana than you cast to start with. It's very easy to cast a bunch of spells and then just play Grapeshot or the other storm spell, which is Empty the Warrens, which makes a bunch of 1/1 goblin tokens, and either of those just generally is in such an insurmountable force of power that it's hard to beat them after that point.
Well, yeah, the whole point of Storm, it's a combo deck, just right. Like, you know, any of the other decks in this format, where if you are able to assemble your combo, you win. Go ahead.
Well, one of the differences, there are a lot of combo decks in Modern. We've talked about a lot of them on the podcast, even, you know. And I think comparing it to Splinter Twin is probably a good way to explain exactly the differences.
Right.
Because Splinter Twin is, we've discussed it before, you know, it's Deceiver, Exarch, Tapper, and Tap. A guy when it comes into play, and Splinter Twin to make a copy of a guy, and that's a 2-card combo. You just make infinite Deceiver Exarchs, kill the opponent. Easy peasy. Storm is not a 2-card combo deck. There aren't any 2 cards that if you cast them on the same turn, you win the game. That's pretty much true, unless your opponent happens to be really aggressive with those Fetch and Shock lands. So instead, it's a kind of combo deck that's usually referred to as a critical mass.
Right.
It's trying to build a certain number of spells or resources of any kind, really, and you're adding them all together.
The whole deck is built around every single card is integral to the entire game.
So as just like a random comparison, you know, the deck is mostly rituals and cantrips. So you have a card like Sleight of Hand, for example, which is single blue to look at the top card of your deck, like top two cards of your deck. You take one, put it in your hand, the other on the bottom of the deck. And alongside that, those cantrips like that, you have cards like Desperate Ritual, which are, you know, one in a red, make 3 red mana.
Right.
So if I, you know, were to say Sleight of Hand, find a Desperate Ritual, cast a Desperate Ritual, I've spent 3 mana, I've made 3 mana, and I've increased my storm count by 2. So obviously that's parity, but because I'm manipulating the actual value out of the number of spells I'm casting, it's not parity. I'm breaking slightly ahead on resources.
Right.
And Storm is packed with other cards that try and take that exact interaction I've just described and, you know, bend it even harder. You've got a card like Goblin Electromancer, which makes all of your instants and sorceries cost 1 mana less. So if I have an Electromancer out in that situation, I'm netting a mana and 2 storm as far as my Sleight of Hand Desperate Ritual interaction. If I have the ability to cast Past in Flames, which is 3 and a red for a sorcery that gives all of the instants and sorceries to my graveyard flashback, now I can recast all of those spells, double the spell count I've gotten, and net mana. And so Storm just builds and builds and builds from this to this. Essentially, you're trying to cascade from... Well, cascade's probably a bad word since that's a mechanic, but you're trying to grow from, you know, having 3, maybe 4 mana available to you to having, you know, as much as 20 mana, 60 mana available to you and a bevy of spells that you're casting and drawing more spells with.
Right.
That basically sums up Storm.
and a lot of the spells do the same thing. That's worth pointing out, too. You know, we cited Desperate Ritual, Paratic Ritual, essentially the same thing. Sleight of Hand and Serum Vision is also very close.
Right.
Manamorphose, essentially not a card. It just thins your deck, increases your spell count, and fixes a little bit of mana.
Right.
Yeah, Goblin Electromancer, very similar to a ritual, although he's a little more powerful than most, but he's also a little more fragile.
Because he makes your other rituals stronger.
Right, and so that's the deck. And it the biggest virtue, I think, of the Storm deck is its ability to run an incredibly low land count.
Yes.
Because that's, you know, the biggest weapon against combo decks is frequently disruption. You're trying to trade one of your cards for one of theirs because their cards are very necessary for them to win. But you know, whatever, I can kill them with whatever's left over.
Right.
You know, if you're playing a deck like Birthing Pod or Jund, you know, any creature can end the game if it's left in play. Obviously, you have more powerful interactions, but realistically, you can attack for lethal with just about anything. So every time you're able to trade one for one with a combo deck, that's generally pretty good for you as long as you're trading for a card that matters. And since it's a combo deck, theoretically every card matters. So Storm's way to try and avoid getting attritioned out by things like that, or even mana leak, is really to just draw more spells, which is pretty easy to do when you have
a
ton of cantrips and, you know, 16 to 18 lands.
You go. I was going to say deck history, but if we have more to say in this,
like you mentioned, one of the best parts about this deck is you run 16 to 18 lands. And if you're a type of person who loves doing stuff every turn and kind of like you're every time you play Storm, it's solving a puzzle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you like solve it, if you're good at solving this puzzle over and over and over again based on the manipulations of your deck and the way that you can carry out these subtle yet crucial manipulations, then, you know, you can win more, way more consistently than somebody who wouldn't. Tossing this deck to somebody who's brand new is actually kind of a, like, good luck, because you're probably going to get it. Right. I can guarantee you're going to make 10 mistakes in the first time you play it. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, it's also good because one of the reasons I like Storm as a deck to eventually start actually playing is because it teaches you a way to play Magic that is so different than normally people are used to, that it helps you with rules understanding. It helps you learn kind of how cards work in a way that's different than the normal I play a creature, I attack with a creature, you block with a creature interaction that is really popular in Standard and even in Modern sees some amount of interaction.
Yep, unless you're killing them with 20 goblins, which you've spent the whole, like,
time
making. Yes, you do kill them turning creatures sideways, but only once, usually.
Now, we've talked a lot about how the deck is, you know, pretty homogenized. Like, a lot of the cards do the same thing, and, you know, you're just trying to grow your mana. But it's worth pointing out, it's a really skill-intensive deck. Not only is it testing skills that a lot of Magic decks don't, but, you know, when all of your cards are, like, kind of similar, but not necessarily exactly similar, that leaves you room to make a lot of mistakes. You can make tiny errors, you know, like burning a Desperate Ritual instead of a Paretic Ritual in, like, a minor moment could very easily bite you because the Desperate Ritual has Splice, which could somehow become relevant later on. Right. Yeah, it's a super minor thing, but, you know, every 1% can matter with Storm because when you get it, you win immediately. When you fail, you lose almost every time. So any 1% mistake can actually kill you.
It punishes mistakes more thoroughly than I think almost any other deck punishes mistakes in the format of Modern. Tier 2 to 1 decks. There are probably tier 3 decks that punish things, but tier 3 is a
format. It's worth noting it's a robust and very powerful deck, so you know, you can certainly kill people making mistakes, but making a mistake generally it matters. Like, it will significantly affect your overall play history with the deck. Like, if you're consistently making errors with Storm, your wins and losses are going to be way different from someone who is consistently perfect with Storm, which incidentally is nobody. So
maybe John Finkel.
Even John has said, you know, that that's why one of the reasons he likes Storm is specifically it's very challenging to him, and he notices when he makes, like, a small error and gets punished for it. So, you know, even the best, that's one of the reasons they like Storm, is that it challenges them. So if it's not for the faint of heart.
Right. And for those who don't know, John Finkel is considered one of the top 2 best Magic players of all time, arguably.
Yeah. And he did write an article about this deck, and I recommend it to everyone who wants to read it.
We'll post it on the page as
Well. He's written a couple, and they are excellent. They are among the best articles written on the deck, I think, for sure. We've talked, you know, returning, the cards are, you know, so similar, and so many of the cards are just rituals, cantrips, and engines.
Right.
So there's not a lot of room to wiggle in your full 75.
Right.
But in the main deck, I think the biggest talking point, and I'll get your opinion on this too, is at Pro Tour Born of the Gods, there was a decided schism between two teams. Team Pantheon and Team TCG Player disagreed over whether to run Desperate Ravings and Thought Scours or Faithless Lootings, basically. And Team TCG Player was a big fan of Faithless Looting, which was single red mana, draw 2, discard 2, and it flashbacks for 2 and a red. So it was good at fueling your graveyard to enable a flashback, pass in flames, kill. Right. And it was also very cheap, and the flashback contributed nicely with Goblin Electromancer. Now, Thought Scour and Desperate Ravings. Thought Scour is a single blue to mill 2 cards and draw a card, so significantly less control than a card like Faithless Looting over what's going to the graveyard, but you know, approximately as efficient and still a similar kind of fuel spell. And then Desperate Ravings, which was 1 in a red to draw 2, discard 1 at random. Again, you know, not much control, but it flashbacked for 2 in a blue. So Desperate Ravings was really excellent at fighting decks that were using Inquisition of Kozilek and Thoughtseize and other 1-for-1 type effects to discard your most important cards, because Desperate Ravings was a 2-for-1. It always nets you a card, if you flash it back, it nets you a second card. So it's a great weapon against those decks. And all the other cards either, you know, just stayed at parity, like Thought Scour just keeps you with the one card, or Faithless Looting could actually, you know, lose you a card, even with the value coming from flashback. So I'm curious, what version of Storm did you prefer?
I like the one with Thought Scour more. But just to help explain my logic behind that one, for those of you who are just, like, picking up Storm, there's 3 engines typically in the deck that you try to shoot for when you're using your blue spells to filter. You have your Goblin Electromancer, and all these engines do something degenerate for the rest of the spells in your deck.
Yes.
So you need to try to get at least, you need to start with one, and then hopefully it draws you into another one, and then you typically win with two going at once. So you have your Goblin Electromancer, which is a blue and a red 2/2 goblin that makes all your spells cost one less, which basically fuels all the rituals and spells you're about to play. So if he stays alive and you untap with him, it's probably game.
Yeah.
That's typically
right. Vast majority of the time.
He is by far the most degenerate engine when just raw power level by himself. The impact he makes when you cast him, it's phenomenal.
He is also the most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. He is, because he's a creature.
He's a creature. Lightning bolt.
A point of contention from actually that Pro Tour Born of the Gods was a lot of the commentators watching, you know, these Storm Pilots playing Goblin Electromancer, they would see them just, you know, run out, turn two Goblin Electromancer, go all the time. And they were like, why isn't he holding it? He can play it on turn three and then play a ritual and then try and go off. And the reason they weren't holding it is if you untap with a Goblin Electromancer, they are dead.
Right.
That is game. So, like, even though it does give them that turn to kill it, if they don't have it, they're dead basically every time. And mm-hmm. if you go to turn three and you try and go off after spending two mana on the Electromancer, not only are you getting a lot less value, you're just losing two mana, really.
Right.
But also, you know, odds are that all the kill spells that might have killed the Electromancer are pretty much still alive to kill it, assuming they hold open any mana. So
they
can still interrupt you in a very similar way. So the EV decision on Goblin Electromancer, that's how powerful it is. You know,
yep.
It is almost a one-card win in the deck, assuming that you actually have drawn spells.
Right.
Yep. So he's definitely one. And playing him now, a couple of things to notice when you're playing Electromancer, all your rituals are instant speed.
Mm-hmm.
So after you land him, if you want to cast a bunch of rituals without your opponent killing your Electromancer or in response to you trying to cast anything, you can retain priority and cast all your spells.
Yep.
Okay. If you have that much mana, mind you, and you have to wait for each one of them to resolve to get more mana, but typically speaking, if you just, like, you play your Electromancer and then go to play another spell after he resolves, your opponent has no chance to kill him before you play out all your other rituals. So as long as you're playing at least three rituals, you're going to be gaining a mana with him.
Yeah, and you need basically four mana to start that up, and it leads to one of the less intuitive plays with the deck, which is, you know, on three mana with one blue, you might play a Desperate Ritual first and then play an Electromancer with two red floating. So now when you go to cast your first ritual, they try and kill it, you cast another ritual and continue chaining from there. Which, you know, normally you would assume you just play your Electromancer, play a ritual, but that gives them that opening to actually shut you down.
Right.
Which, you know, it can matter.
Yep, so if you understood that,
then you're on the way to piloting store.
Exactly. Okay, the second pillar that I want to discuss is Pass and Flames. This is the original Storm Enabler that came out with mm-hmm. Innistrad. When this card got printed, every Storm player just, like, threw their arms in the air and started, you know, basically getting really excited because Yogg's Will was reprinted in a, like, actually cool card.
Right.
And everyone else started rubbing their forehead.
Yes, they did. Pass and Flames was a very awesomely designed card now. It costs three and a red, and it basically grants, in that specific moment, every single instant sorcery in your graveyard flashback equal to its converted mana cost.
Until
end of turn.
Yeah.
So, when you cast Pass and Flames, I suggest all new cards that you choose to put in your graveyard from there need to go in another pile. Okay? It's very important that you keep these piles separate because the first pile are going to have all flashback spells and the second one will not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like Yogg's Will for the rest of the turn this happens. It's only the cards that exist in the graveyard when you cast your Pass and Flames will have flashback. Now, good thing is Pass and Flames has a flashback cost, so if you want to get the rest of those that you put in the second pile of flashback, you can always just flashback the...
I have to be honest, I think Pass and Flames flashback is like one of the most unnecessary instances of flashback in Magic history, but it does come up a lot, because as you said, you know, once you've got it in the graveyard, you cast a bunch of spells, now we've talked about escalating from that 4 mana to that 20 mana, now's a great time to flashback that Pass and Flames and reuse everything else.
Right. And the flashback is five and a, or four and
four
a red.
Red, yep.
Four
and
red.
So it's just one more to flashback, which is why you know, the second Team Pantheon was playing the Faithless Lootings, is because they could count on discarding this card and putting it in the yard.
Yeah, TCG player, yep.
Oh, sorry, TCG mm-hmm. player. Pantheon did the other one. Okay, and the final pillar is Pyromancer Ascension, which I'm pretty sure the R&D team had no idea it was going to, like, turn out the way it did.
Right, they probably like, this is a fun card.
Pyromancer Ascension is one red enchantment. Every time you cast a spell...
One red and a colorless.
One in red.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One in red, enchantment. Every time you cast a spell, if there's a copy of that card in your graveyard, you put a counter on it. Once the Pyromancer Ascension has two counters on it, every time you would cast a instant or sorcery after, it gets copied for free. So basically, if you like casting, you know, your spells once, it's going to be great casting them for a second time for free, and you don't have to do anything else to it. So so you have Goblin Will Expanse, reducing the cost of everything by one, helping you win that way. Pass in Flames, basically giving all the cards you've already played a second chance. And then Pyromancer Ascension, doubling every single cast you make.
Right.
Which is, I think Pyromancer is the worst once it's online, but I said in raw power because you need to spend time getting it online.
It's the toughest.
It's the hardest, but definitely the most degenerate.
Right. It's probably the hardest to get rid of, but most difficult to get online, while Electromancer is the easiest to get rid of, but hardest to get, or easiest. Easy to get rid of and easiest to get online.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yep. And Electromancer, good to point out, is that it's relatively difficult to kill someone with just an Electromancer. Like, usually you have to go Electromancer and feed into a Pass in Flames, which is not that difficult to get to, but it happens. But relatively rarely do you actually kill someone with just playing a Goblin Electromancer and then playing a bunch of spells, that none of which are named Pass in Flames. Pyromancer Ascension, on the other hand, if you turn on a Pyromancer Ascension, it is very easy to kill someone from there. It is incredibly powerful.
Yep.
It kind of gives almost every single card mini Storm to a certain extent, where it's
Storm 1.
Right, sure. Yeah, Storm 1 every time. So that's...
Which is what the deck's trying to do anyway.
Right.
So just go full like that.
So it is worth noting the copies do not count towards your actual Storm count, since you're not casting those spells.
Yes. Don't count those.
Don't grape shot for 11. You need the full 20.
Exactly. So yeah, typically speaking, I want to try to grab two out of the three degenerate engines that are in the deck.
And
most of the decks actually run four copies of Electromancer, four Pyromancer Ascensions, and anywhere from two or three Pass in Flames.
Right.
And the reason is because Pass in Flames is expensive.
Right.
It's the most expensive spell in the deck. And while you want to be able to reuse your whole graveyard, sometimes that option isn't really available because of the deck you're playing against and a couple other options. So it's not actually the go-to, but you always want to draw one.
Right.
And your deck is going to be able to do that.
Two other really relevant facts is it's, of the three, it's one that you don't want to, or I should say you can't really effectively start with. You know, a Goblin Electromancer can lead into a Pass in Flames or a Pyromancer Ascension. Pyromancer Ascension can lead into something else. A Pass in Flames leads into nothing. It's it's the end of the road. Like, once you're flashbacking Pass in Flames, that's when you're, like, really preparing to kill somebody.
Well, and always a good rule when deck building is, if I want to cast this on turn two every single time, every single turn two possible, I want to play as many as possible. If I want to get to it by turn four or later, or get to it when I need to and I can search for it, then you don't need the full four, especially because it could clog your hand up.
And the more cards you run, like Thought Scour and Desperate Ravings, those cards give you additional chances to hit a Pass in Flames and still be able to cast it, because if it goes to the graveyard, you can just flash it back. It's one mana more expensive, but when you're at the stage of the game where you're Pass in Flamesing, a lot of the times that one mana is negligible. Not always. I wouldn't even say the majority of the time, but enough of the time that it's free value.
Okay, so now to answer the question, which version do I like more? Now that we've established everything that needs to go, I like Thought Scour a lot because of the gauntlet that the Storm has to play against. There's a lot of black running around that makes you discard cards.
Sure.
So while Faithless Looting is a great card to pick and choose, and in a vacuum, the Solitaire version of it I think is stronger than because you have more control of what you're discarding. But that negative one card actually tends to affect the game in a longer term. Yeah. And your outs become less. Your deck becomes more volatile in terms of exploding fast, but it also becomes a lot more like reliant on making sure your opponent doesn't disrupt you, right? That one less card is one less resource, which needs the Storm deck really needs in this format these days. So while you have no control over milling two with Thought Scour, which whatever those cards are going to be, I mean, unless you Serum Visioned and you know what's on the top of your deck, you really aren't going to get much of a chance, and you kind of have to just take your deck on faith. So you honestly play the statistics games with Storm every matchup, and you know what? If you're a great pilot, because you can manipulate the resources in lieu of that variance, great. If you just get beaten down by bad luck, that happens too. It's magic. So that's why Storm is super fun. I think.
Right.
It's certainly a good deck to, you know, kind of learn both Magic and yourself, because it's a deck you see yourself grow with. You know, when you make a mistake, you recognize it. Next time you don't do it, and you just keep going and going and going. It's a deck that rewards practice pretty heavily. And I like that about it.
Yep. It's truly exploring every possibility of the cards that you have in your hand and going forward from there, while at the same time considering what your opponent can do to disrupt you. That's the... I mean, I know that's the same kind of concept for every kind of...
For a deck that plays Solitaire, there's a lot of... Yeah, like you're imagining the two-way street, really. Like you're playing both sides of the game in your own head. You're just trying to make sure it doesn't actually manifest the bad way on the board.
And because, like I said, it's a puzzle. Because you play Gitaxian Probe, you know what your opponent has.
Right.
So you have... This is why Storm is awesome, and this is why Finkel plays it. It's because you have perfect knowledge of the board and the game state when you are playing it, usually. That doesn't happen with a lot of decks.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't. Rare. A lot of people like, if you can encompass and take control over all elements of the game, you can find a route to victory if you're capable of
doing it. Right.
So
that's and it's from an angle that, like, most decks, at least at first, aren't, like, generally built to be able to handle those situations easily. So you have, like, I have an angle of attack, and I know what you're going to try doing, so I can manipulate my angle in a way that easily dodges what you're going to try and do.
Yeah, you have a lot of generally favorable game ones, and there is significant sideboard hate, especially post-Pro Tour Born of the Gods. It came back.
Right.
Yes.
Oh my god, yes. But you, as a Storm player, like, you actually don't get access to the same levels. You know, you can't dilute your deck too much, or you just won't be able to implement your plan at all. You know, drawing... We talked about Blood Moon, which is a card that can just straight up win, which is why it's a reasonable sideboard card for Storm, because, you know, if you can just Desperate Ritual into a Blood Moon against a certain deck on turn two, they might just not play Magic anymore. You might have completely ended any threat they bore to your ability to win.
Right.
But, you know, if any other card, you know, say you were running, I don't know, a Counterspell, just for a random example, as like, that's your, like, anti-hate card. You know, you draw, like, two or three Counterspells in a game. Your opponent can still play Magic, even though you're making these, like, theoretically favorable trades by shutting off their hate cards. You're not drawing enough of your own critical mass to actually kill them.
You're your own hate card.
Right. You've essentially mulliganed in exchange for not facing hate. But if you think about it, like, what if you were in game one and you mulled to five against an opponent who doesn't have any of their sideboard cards? Are you a favorite?
Right.
Maybe, but probably not. Like, your deck's not designed to work on five cards well.
Yeah. When your deck is built to have as many cards as possible, limiting what cards you have is a mistake more often than
so anything. You really can only afford to sideboard in answers to their answers if the answer is very powerful or handles, like, all of their answers. Which is why, you know, you see cards in Storm sideboard specifically, like Blood Moon, which, you know, we just said it can just straight up kill some people by taking away their ability to play Magic. Shatterstorm. Which destroys all artifacts. Yeah. So in the matchup, you bring that in Affinity. It mostly kills the opponent. Obviously, it doesn't actually kill them, but it usually buys you plenty of time to sculpt and come back from the fact that you had to mulligan in order to essentially stop them from killing you.
Are you of the opinion that Shatterstorm is better than Vandalblast?
I think it's kind of varies. I think right now Vandalblast is probably better, just because Grafdigger's Cage is the hate card du jour. For those not listening, for those not aware of Grafdigger's Cage, it's a one-drop artifact that shuts down your ability to flashback cards from the graveyard, as well as, you know, search your deck for creatures or get creatures back from the graveyard, which Birthing Pod happens to do a lot. So people have turned to Grafdigger's Cage as a hate card against Birthing Pod that also splashes a little onto graveyard decks like Storm. And so being able to take care of a Grafdigger's Cage and kill someone that way is useful, and Vandalblast is much better at that than, say, a Shatterstorm if you were going to board it in. That said, I would probably currently be running something like a 1 Vandalblast, 2 Shatterstorm or something like that, because I don't really want to draw multiple Vandalblasts. Like, if they draw their cage, I want to have my 1 Vandalblast, and that's enough for me. Because you can kill someone through a Grafdigger's Cage with a Pyromancer Ascension.
Yep.
It doesn't need you to flashback cards. So there's kind of this give and take, and that's why I think Storm might be poised a little bit to come back if, you know, these Jund decks are cooling their heels a little bit on some of that disruption.
Yep. Certain cards that you want to, like, take into consideration when you're sideboarding for any match. If any opponent's playing white, you can count on some sort of...
Rule of Law or...
Aethersworn Canonist.
Cards that say...
Even Meddling Mage can be played. What's the one for? Eidolon of Rhetoric.
Eidolon of Rhetoric is possibly
the best one. The most played.
It's certainly the most powerful. I don't necessarily know if it's the best, because it's the hardest for Storm to actually beat.
Right.
The others, like, you can Vandalblast an Aethersworn Canonist. Rule of Law costs 3 mana, so it's like, so comes it's, down a little late. So does the Eidolon. What I'm saying. Like, those are hard for you to remove, but you can actually, you know, kill them theoretically before they can cast it or find
if
it.
You're on the play.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. like those ones are very difficult for Storm to deal with,
mm-hmm.
Because the best you can hope for is drawing your one removal spell for them,
right?
And getting your something to note: if they land one of these and you have an active Pyromancer Ascension, the copies are okay when you mm-hmm. cast.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't contribute to Storm, but by the same token, they don't get shut off by the rule
right.
law.
You're not casting a spell, you're copying a spell. So
if you once you get that online, digging through your deck becomes a lot more efficient because you get to play two spells a turn, but your opponent doesn't. Something to note.
Mm-hmm. Very true. One of the ways to fight these cards that has caught on a little bit, I wouldn't say it's become the mainstream version of Storm or anything, is that some people have splashed white into their Storm deck. Which I actually did at Grand Prix Kansas City ages ago. Thought I was very clever. I was not. But it has become a little bit of a thing since the printing of Wear and Tear, because Wear and Tear can function as, that destroy target artifact to take care of a Grafdigger's Cage or an Aetherstorm Canist. It can also function as that destroy target enchantment, take care of a Rule of Law or an Eidolon of Rhetoric. So it's right. a lot less powerful than something like Shatterstorm, but it handles the vast majority of actual hate cards you'll see. So if you draw one Wear and Tear over the course of a game, it doesn't matter what hate card your opponent is sideboarded in against you, they have to draw two copies. The wear and tear will answer the first one.
Right.
That's exactly right. Usually Storm decks play four Bolts on the board also.
Very common, yeah.
This is because Bolt is a great defense against any kind of creature-based deck. Also hits almost every, except for the new 1/4, which is why a lot mm-hmm. of Storm players were upset. Eidolon of Rhetoric
yes.
kind of took away the ability for Storm to just answer it with Burn.
Right.
Also, I've bolted people out of games plenty of times with
a combination of Bolt and Grapeshot and then hurting themselves with lands.
Well, I mean, it's theoretically possible to, with a single copy of Lightning Bolt, deal 24 damage.
Oh,
so,
right.
Or actually more than that. Yeah, you can deal...
well, if you have infinite Pyromancer Ascensions...
Yeah, that's like if you turn on like four Pyromancer Ascensions and Lightning Bolt once, you got 15 and then flash it back, you got another 15. So you can deal theoretically 30.
Right.
With a single copy of Lightning Bolt. And so a lot of the times if your opponent's trying to fight you with something like a Surgical Extraction or even a Slaughter Games, you can bring in a Bolt or two and still have outs to be able to kill them, even if they resolve a spell
there,
like
there's
that.
There's a game C plan that you can go
yes.
for that
yep.
is feasible.
Emergency release.
And then you always bring in one copy of Echoing Truth in almost exclusively every matchup because it's your permanent base removal. It's a blue bounce spell for mm-hmm. one and a blue. But it also hits all copies of the same.
Right, so it gets rid of if mm-hmm. they... I have two...
If they haven't diversified
their
hate, yeah.
Graftigger's Cages.
Exactly. It answers all copies of the card that's preventing you from winning that moment. Also, if you're retroactively, if you're playing against the Storm Mirror and they land a bunch of goblins against you, you can bounce all of them back to their hand, and they've literally just lost at that point.
Right.
It can also save your ascension from an abrupt decay, which is rare as a thing you want to do, but it comes up. I've
right,
done
right.
it. I wasn't proud, but I did.
Well,
it.
That Echoing Truth can be given flashback later on, so even
yeah,
the
exactly.
fact that you had to waste it that first time on saving the win condition that if you get off, you win instantly,
yep.
it makes it worth it.
So if... Like, there's certain cards that people bring in, like White Leyline, that are just a joke.
Yeah.
They really don't matter for you at all.
You just ignore it until you're ready to kill them. Because that's one of the things about the Storm Deck, too. Like, a Singleton Echoing Truth, you mentioned you always bring in the one. If someone is playing something like a White Leyline, when Storm goes off, which Leyline of Sanctity does not prevent it from doing, the going off part is the drawing your entire deck, essentially. I now have that Echoing Truth. It doesn't matter where it was. If it was the 60th card... I'm good. Bounce that ley line. Grape shot you. We're done here.
Right.
Yeah, like we mentioned earlier, it's getting a critical mass, but at a certain point, like, you just skyrocket through the atmosphere and you're making hundreds of mana mm-hmm. and drawing infinite number of cards. Well, don't obviously say that because you will deck yourself and lose,
yeah.
but, just try
right.
Say your opponent can definitely see where you're going, and unfortunately, you do have to play it out.
Yeah.
So, because there's no way to just, flip your deck over and show your opponent how you
and
win.
Those games are impressive, but the difficult games to win with Storms are the game where you're grape-shotting for, like, Xaxxes.
Yes.
Like, those are the tough games where you have to navigate on the razor's edge.
Right.
And then, let's see, other sideboard cards. Anger the Gods has been used in a couple sideboards against Affinity and Pod.
Yeah.
Though I think Anger of the Gods is falling a little bit out of favor, or
mostly because of the Eidolon. I think that's kind
of
what it
right.
When Pod was relying on Aetherstorm Canonist, it was fine because you got to sweep them up,
right?
And it also doubled as like a Shatterstorm type effect where you were like setting their game plan back so far that it was worth the trade off for you. But I think now it's more of a like card worth respecting as opposed to a card you should jam all of them in your
right,
deck.
Right, right.
No, my favorite's jamming Four Blood Moons in the board.
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you. I just want to be like, stop. You're done here.
But do you guys think now with the printing of the new fetch lands that that becomes a little bit of a losing prospect?
I mean, it's certainly worse.
Blood Moon.
It's a worse card just because their mana will be a little better, but it's still viable because of how early you can play it.
Right.
Exactly. When you can turn two Blood Moons against anybody, if they haven't, like, they typically will play like a shock turn one and or, you know, some sort of land that comes in a tapped or maybe a fetch that hasn't been cracked yet and they fetch a tapped land, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's typically how Modern goes. It's very rare to see like a basic land being played turn one unless it's a two color deck.
Right.
And you know, Modern's getting to that point. Well,
I think that the Blood Moon plan is much stronger on the play than on the draw. Obviously that's true, but specifically because of the fetch lands. As most decks, like the Jund deck is really the biggest one where you're into Blood Mooning them. And so when they're on the play, they can do like turn one, shock or fetch for a black source, thought sees you, you play a land, then they can fetch or get their forest into play, play their guy, and now they're good. Right. So they've had that chance to both disrupt you and get the forest in play. But when you're on the play, on turn one, they can either thought sees you or they can get a forest. They can't do both. Mm-hmm. It is impossible. So you can still threaten a turn two Blood Moon against those decks.
Right, and something I kind of forgot is that this is one of the few decks that does do turn two Blood Moon because of the rituals. And that's one of the reasons that, like, because other decks, there's talk that Blood Moon becomes worse in them because a turn three Blood Moon might not be good enough anymore because if you know they're on that plan, you can fetch correctly. But against Storm, you have maybe one land you can grab, and even then, you might be out of luck.
Blood Moon certainly just got worse across the board. In Storm, it retains more of its previous value than it used to, I think.
Mm-hmm. The fact that they can also fetch perfect, like, basics is with the fetches does make it a little worse.
Right.
But they're only going to play, like, one or two. Or maybe three if they're playing one of each of the colors and they can just play non-basics for the rest of them. So if you can get them with the Blood Moon before they get those out, I mean, you're shining.
Right.
That's the trick.
and that's why Blood Moon becomes so awesome. Because and even against the control decks that don't even play Mountains, if they don't have the counterspell to get this for you, right? Let's say they go turn one, like, tap land, like a Colonnade or something. Mm-hmm. You're just like, Blood Moon, it is over for them.
Right.
They are in, like, Sadville. Anything.
Sadville's the worst.
It is pretty bad.
I don't like it there. Everyone's sad.
that's why I personally love Blood Moon to just jam.
All right, so let's walk through real quick the Gauntlet. This, you know, the decks we go through every week to kind
of talk
about.
I really just want to say Grape Shot like every time. Is that...
All right, so how do you beat Jund?
Grape Shot.
Okay.
Actually, no, that's probably not a great plan. Against Jund, you really want to go for the desperate ravings. And post-board, Empty the Warrens is actually like pretty good against Jund because it forces them to basically have Anger of the Gods, as the vast majority of the other planes are not good against like an empty for eight or ten goblins, you can do through a Thought Seize. You can't Grape Shot someone for 20 getting Thought Seized every other turn, but you can empty them. That you can do.
Exactly. Yeah, Grape. The reason why the board packs about three Empty the Warrens is because you switch game plans against any deck playing black. They will destroy your hand within a few turns, and you really can't afford to be slower than turn three against them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, your resources just become very dwindled.
And it's a lot easier to grind out a game with Empty the Warrens where you can attack multiple turns if you need to kill them versus just hope the one-shot Grape Shot.
Outside of its sweepers, Jund is horrible at defending itself from a bunch of 1/1s. That's one of the reasons that Young Pyromancers actually started seeing a little bit of play because it's so good against cards like Liliana of the Veil.
Right.
And even to some extent Lightning Bolt if you can generate some value before they actually get to kill your guy. And Empty the Warrens just like it's the Young Pyromancer without the Pyromancer. Right. Here's a bunch of dude.
There was a sideboard plan for people who feared the graveyard plan, when Rest in Peace was just running all over the place because people thought it was, you know, the Soul Sisters loved playing those because they didn't have anything to do with the graveyard.
Well, I mean, it gets rid of Birthing, or hurts Birthing Pot, it hurts you, it hurts Storm, it hurts
everything.
Lingering Souls, it hurts Snapcaster Mage, which is everywhere, it hurts, and then you, like, randomly hedge against stuff like, what's the grave, all the creatures come back.
Oh,
Living End?
Destroys Living End.
Yeah. These days, most people are going with Grafdigger's Cage first and Relic of Progenitus second.
Right.
Which is fortunate for Storm because both of those cards are much more beatable than something like a Rest in Peace.
Right.
Which really detracts so much from what you're doing. A Relic of Progenitus, while it gives them the ability to somewhat counter a Pass in Flames. If you, you know, play correctly, you can actually still get a pretty effective Pass in Flames by casting it, allowing them to resolve their relic activation, and then you go ahead and add a couple more rituals before your Pass in Flames resolves in order to be able to flash them back and keep going.
Right.
So those two cards are both much easier to beat than an ongoing Rest in Peace because you can actually build a mass. A Pyromancer Ascension, also you can turn it on against the Relic of Progenitus. It's harder, but you can do it. Like, they actually have to, you know, start paying attention to what's going on.
They do. Relic is just the generic kind of answer. Because it cantrips, it's good.
Right.
But I honestly, a very beatable card, as long as you can manipulate the resources.
You got to know what you're doing, but you can do it.
Mm-hmm. So next, blue, white, red, since we've talked about that one before, or last week. Blue, white, red, the game plans that it has against you are A, counter magic, B, the sideboard has all of the access to all those white sideboard cards we were talking about.
Yeah, they can win a little bit of hate. And they have access to counter magic. Pyromancer Ascension is your best weapon against them by miles.
Right.
An active Pyromancer Ascension is very difficult for them to beat until at least they are sideboarding for wear and tears or can get to Cryptic Command mana. Fortunately, your plan is to kill them literally the turn before they could cast a Cryptic Command, That's not that difficult. You want to watch out for mana leaks and remands. Spell Snare has fortunately become a lot less popular, and it's one of the best counter spells against your deck by miles because it counters Electromancer and Pyromancer Ascension and every ritual in your deck. So that's good.
Yeah, if they're running a full four of Spell Snare, it becomes that much harder to beat them.
Almost impossible at that point because Spell Snare into Snapcaster Mage Spell Snare is like just going to take you out, take the wind right out of your sails. Your Electromancers are pretty bad. They have a lot of removal for them. So even though, you know, you have that, I get to untap and win, like it will very, very rarely happen.
Yeah, the chances for blue, white, red that have no creature removal that's also relevant, keeping it against you is low.
So blue, white, red actually has decreased a little bit in popularity since it came out. So that when it was actually a little bit higher in popularity, I threw in a couple quickens in my board to try to deal with their whatever they were to stop me, which actually ended up being efficient. Like
can believe that.
Yeah, when they went Snapcaster, remand your thing, you could be like, okay, quicken, grape shot, hit your, your Snapcaster, and then you get your ritual back, and then you can keep going with whatever, and then, you know, there was instance and sorceries that you could play at unfair times that literally beat them after they've tapped out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, being able to Pass in Flames in their end step for some random value could certainly matter. against Blue White Red, you board the Blood Moons that we talked about are really, really good in that matchup because it really stresses their ability to remove an enchantment. We already discussed Pyromancer Ascension is close to a win. When you have Blood Moon and Pyromancer Ascension, that's more enchantments than they can remove.
Right.
So drawing additional copies is also still pretty good. The Empty the Warrens plan is okay against them as well. You don't really want to side like all the way out against Grapeshot, but you just want to try and... The easiest way to beat counter magic is to be able to present consistent multifaceted pressure. Like when you go all in, you run the risk of getting shut down, but if you're, you know, firing at them like a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, you can put them on defense and generally get them. It's a little tougher if they're running I shouldn't say tougher, but a little more dangerous to do something like that if they're running the Resto Angel Kiki variant, because they can just kill you if you're not trying to just kill them.
Yep, which kind of segues into Tarmo Twin, right? Is that the next deck you want to talk about?
Or Twin in general is the next pillar. So that includes Tarmo Twin and regular Twin.
Yep.
So Twin is kind of the major other combo deck. We talked about how earlier they kind of different, where one is much more about a synergistic entire deck game plan versus one's about getting two cards into play at the same time and winning.
I've always found Twin to be a pretty tough matchup for Storm. Have you had similar experience? It feels a lot like they're a blue white red deck that never gets colded by Blood Moon and can still just kill me out of nowhere. So those are dangerous things to be.
Well, the problem is every time you think you can combo before they can, they just counter you and then have the two cards they need always to just get you back. However, in sideboarding, Swansong has actually been
pretty decent. Swansong gave you some percentage, that's for sure.
Swansong is the card to bring in against Twin.
So explain what's Swansong.
Swansong is a one blue instant that says counter target instant, sorcery, or enchantment.
And it gives that person a 2/2 birdie.
Yeah.
Flying.
Which is irrelevant against Storm.
Yeah, you don't.
Pretty close to irrelevant. To be fair, Twin can nickel and dime you out, but like your goal is to win before that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Worth noting is that the Wear Tear version, they have access to Wear Tear, which disables Splinter Twin, so they also have that additional weapon.
Right, because I mean, something interesting that has happened, and it makes sense because Theros block was an enchantment block, is that enchantment removal has become much more relevant the last year than it was for the last decade.
Yeah, they've printed better enchantment removal, for right. sure. Certainly more diverse. You know, we've talked about Soul Tide Charm a little bit. Wear-Tear is one of the best enchantment, disenchant variants ever printed.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
It really is. It was a cool card to have.
Yes. You know, that was like, when Dragon's Maze came out, that was my card. I was like, everyone else was, you know, excited about all the multicolor or the fatties or whatever. I was like, ooh, they made Wear-Tear. This is great. What are you guys talking about?
Usually the choice to destroy artifacts or enchantments is not... It's usually with green, having both options. Yeah.
The elegance of the card is, too. Like, it's always the most efficient thing at what it's doing, pretty much.
Yep, and it's a possible 2-for-1, so...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Twin, for the most part, is going to be an uphill battle, regardless of how you want to run things.
Right.
I like to just go all in. Like, I just try. Like, whenever mm-hmm. I think I can kill them, just go for it, because if they can't stop me, I win. If they can, I probably wasn't going to win anyway.
Yeah, your statistical average versus Twin is not the greatest. Might as well, you know, go for the high variant option instead of the, like... Let's see if I can drag it out, because they can always just turn for you and you're dead.
Twin is a deck that's really hard to drag out because they're always going to be able to just, if you stumble, I win. And Storm doesn't have a good way to kind of deal with that stumble as well.
Yeah,
you
can't interact with them and they can't interact with you. That's really the crux of the issue. Your kill turn is basically very similar, if not the same. Obviously, they can never turn 3, but like at the same time, you can very rarely turn 3 twins. So it's not that different.
Exactly.
But their interaction actually contributes to them being able to further the game against you.
Right. So. What you do to make it so all of your cards all kind of to make you a little bit more consistent and your entire deck is going for a specific game plan, you're getting rid of interaction, while Twin is getting rid of some of that consistency for pure interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you don't have much to combat that.
Right.
Especially post-board. Like, your swan songs are barely beating whatever they're trying to throw in at you, and they go in, like, dispels.
Right.
Yeah, like, they way get more much efficient. Better.
Yeah, their plan to stop you from doing your stuff is way better than your plan to stop them.
Right.
So, it's unfortunate, but also the deck isn't seeing as much play. Pod is becoming more popular.
More popular, yeah. So, speaking of Pod, let's just segue right into that one.
I don't know, it's kind of a...
It can be tricky, I think that a familiarity with Pod itself is really important. I think the matchup is generally favorable, but
at least
I know,
game one.
At least game
right,
one.
Before they board
I know
Thoughtsies
Pod players who certainly would disagree, but you know that's kind of the natural bias. You always think that you know how to play your deck in the matchup and that you know how to handle it. So I think that it's close. I would much rather have the Storm deck just because, you know, we've talked about it. When you can't stop me, I kill you. That's huge. Like, when I can't kill Pod first, like, they play a Kitchen Finks or something. Like,
I know.
It's not
also
that big a deal.
Them getting Reclamation Sage was really good.
Yeah, Reclamation Sage is a really efficient creature that can kill a Pyromancer Ascension, 2 and a green for a 2/1. And it's also good in a variety of other matchups, so it just gave them another card that they can actually afford to play.
They now have Reclamation Sage and Eidolon out of the side, so they have two of the better kind of efficient ways of kind of dealing with what you're kind of trying to do.
The Sage is easier to cast and more aggressive than Harmonic Sliver as well.
Right.
So, it's a small thing, but it matters. So overall, I like being on the Storm side more than the Pod side, and I think that was borne out in the Pro Tour, even though, in Pro Tour Born of the Gods, the Pod player beat the Storm player in top 8, but it was relatively fortunate that that happened. Abrupt Decay hinged the entire game, and Pod is not Jund. It doesn't run for Abrupt Decays, generally speaking. It usually runs like 2, mm-hmm. maybe 3.
Yep. Right. The thing with Pod is, Pod's plan against you is they have... somewhere between 3 and 4 Thoughtseizes in their 75. They have between 2 and 4 Abrupt Decays in their 75. I think actually now they're starting to run 4. And 1 Eidolon. And the enchantment and artifact removal. And those things are kind of... they're going to try and stop you, but they're way better game 2 than game 1. So game 1 is a much more of a free roll than normal. Or not normal, but against like these blue decks we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so... that's kind of the benefit against Pod, and then it really comes down to that turn games 2 and 3, if they get their hate cards against you, or if you can get off before they can get a Pod online.
Exactly. Yeah, this is unfortunately where Anger of the Gods fell real short. Anger of the Gods like took away 2 to 3 turns of Pod before the Eidolon came out. And maybe we're valuing that Eidolon too good, but it's been a pain for me to deal with every time. Like, Wear and Tear is a much stronger card against Pod because they play enchanted creatures.
Right.
And, I mean, I wasn't doing bolts before Anger. I was putting the Angers in and keeping the bolts out. But now I'm starting to put more bolts in against Pod because you need to nuke the dorks.
Right. Well, I can imagine also Wear and Tear, though, has some benefit because you can... oh, you hit tear their too. Pod and wear their Eidolon gets a nice little game.
You when you try to battle a pod on its own, like the speed wise, you unless you're super lucky, you're probably not going to win. Right? It's right. just the way the pod deck, they put out mana dorks, which increases their clock. You don't.
Well, I think that their uninterrupted nut draw is worse than yours, generally speaking. But they are, again, it becomes post-board, they look a lot more like twin than they did pre-board. Like, they have That's actual right. ways to interact with you. So similarly to that matchup, you have to right. address them. They have way less ways, they're not as threatening. The like, they can't essentially instant speed kill you by, you know, end of turn, this guy, untap this guy, kill you.
Right.
You're generally, assuming you're familiar with the matchup, you're going to be aware of what could happen to you.
Right.
So I would, for that matchup, I think it's really close. I think it favors Storm slightly, and I would say you just got to play test it a bunch.
What Pod kind of ends up doing is it's kind of, especially in sideboard games, it kind of ends up being the middle point between what Twin is and what Jund is, where it's playing where it's playing those black cards, these like the Abrupt Decays and Spell. So these are the things that are going to stop you kind of what you're doing, but then it also has a level of interaction in a game plan end game that can just outright stop you from winning.
Yeah, it's a hybrid right. combo mid-range, although hybro is a great word.
The difference though is that it has a better game plan against Empty the Warrens than Jund does, where it has
Orzhov Pontiff.
Putting empties in against Pod is probably not right. Maybe right. one.
Yeah.
If that. I think you're on your main game plan with Grape Shot.
Yeah.
Yep. When you try to beat them.
Yeah, most of their ways to attack you are the less disruption and more specific answers to your strategy. Like Decay for your Ascension is really their Sage is really their primary method right. of interacting with you. And outside of that, they're just going to try and lock you out from being able to win with something like Eidolon, as we've discussed. So, and Jund doesn't have access to anything like that. Like Jund is all about just knock you apart to the point where you can't try to win. Pod doesn't do anything like that. They're just like, this is in play. You can't win now. Please don't answer before I kill you.
right.
So and that's a different way to approach it. And so empty is great for, you know, being able to battle back with few pieces. But right. Pod doesn't really restrict your pieces. They restrict your overall ability to play Magic.
Right. So next, let's talk about Affinity. You know, we talked about it in episode one. It's the artifact, get in your face, all the artifacts, all the time deck. I would imagine one of the biggest problems with this is just it's kind of a race where Affinity can kill you out at almost as quickly as you can kill them. So it's who can kill the other person the quickest.
Yeah.
It's win the die roll.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You're both in some ways very similar decks as far as being like a critical mass style deck. Like you're trying to play a bunch of artifact dudes. You're trying to play a bunch of rituals. Neither of you have much interaction with the other. Post-board, they can access some things like Thoughtseize or Spell Pierce, but depending on how you build your sideboard, maybe you have access to, you know,
Shatterstorm,
Wear Tear, whatever, at a minimum. Yeah. Maybe share Shatterstorm, Vandalblast, some real Haymakers. So it depends, I think, mostly on the sideboards as to who is the larger favorite. Game one, I agree with Leo, it's mostly pretty coin flippy. Maybe I would give a slight edge to Storm just because they have no answer to an Ascension. So if you're like turn two Ascension, you can generally win pretty frequently from that position. Which in other matchups is not necessarily always the case.
Well, and against Affinity, doing the get that Goblin Electromancer out there. The
They have also similarly few answers to that.
It's like, okay, yay, I win.
So I like Storm in game one slightly, but again, you know, they can definitely nut you fast enough.
I think it's whoever wins the die roll game one.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's a tiny thing, but I think it's mostly like, you know, like, they're 65% if they win the die roll, and we're 70, so, like, it's, like, slightly better for us. But, like, I agree that whoever does win the die roll is the favorite in a given game, for sure. I just think over the course of, like, a large sample, we have a slight edge.
I agree.
You wanted, also, to kind of round out the aggro section, we want to talk about Zoo and kind of burn with Affinity. The main reason that this is important is the new red Eidolon, which is... Eidolon of the Great Revel, which is a red and a red enchantment creature that anytime a spell with three or less mana is cast, it does...
Two
damage to the player who casts it.
Yep.
Right. Which, this falls under the category of Wizards wants to produce quality hate bear creatures.
Right.
You know, for the fact that it's in red and it does this unique ability, it's something that hasn't... Is there any other card in Magic?
Pyrostatic Pillar, actually. It's a creature form of Pyrostatic Pillar.
Yeah, the Pyrostatic Pillar is just an enchantment. It's so an enchantment. It's really just...
This enchantment does the same thing.
Yeah, this is Wizards just making it a creature like a bunch of
others.
Which, obviously,
especially in
big
Theros.
Game for its playability because it becomes a main deckable card. Even in decks that themselves run a lot of cheap cards. Idol of Great Revel is actually a card that I think has yet to find, like, its true homes in Legacy and Modern. Obviously, it's a fantastic card for Burn, and that is a deck where it belongs, as it, you know,
right,
has a very high damage output in both formats. But I feel like it's, because of its the virtue of it being a creature that can, like, legitimately threaten people, I think it's better than that. I think it can go in other decks, too. I just I think we haven't explored them that fully. Like, I'm interested in doing, like, turn one Wild Nacatl, turn two Idol of Great Revel. Like, that's something you can do. That's totally reasonable. Like, there are a lot of easy ways to play that combination.
Yep. And then just some decks just scoop, like Storm. I mean, like, really, that card, your game plan is Lightning
Bolt. It's a very, very powerful card.
Right.
Game one, we have to use a spell, get shocked, and then Grape Shot and get shocked again.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's at least four damage to the face.
And you're losing a win condition. And
no, I mean, using a Grape Shot to answer it is fine.
The tricky part about that is just having the Grape Shot itself. Like, you have to draw one and you don't run all that many.
Yeah, you run like two.
Sometimes three, but mostly two, because you only need one. So and unchecked, you can't win.
Pretty much. That guy comes out turn two, Storm is pretty much just packing it up.
Okay, guys, so that's it for Storm. You know, I want to thank you guys for listening. This is actually kind of, you know, the wrap of the episode. Thank you, Leo, for coming. If you guys are doing any major tournaments in the Southern California area, Leo is most likely going to be a judge there, so give him a big high five and thank him for helping out. You know where to find us. All that information will be at the end of the podcast. All of the articles and deck lists that we mentioned will be posted in the links below. We'd like to also give a shout out to our sister podcast, The Command Cast. Jimmy and Josh do awesome Commander content and do a bunch of multiplayer fun stuff and do deck techs every week as well, every Tuesday. And lastly, you know, everyone say goodbye. Leo?
Bye, guys. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, it's been great. Enjoy.
All right, see you guys next week.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to themcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @KessWiley and @SecludedGlenn. See you later, alligator.